Welcome back to How They Train. I'm Jack Kelly, and today I'm joined by one of the best triathlon coaches on the planet, Dan Plews. I've asked Dan to come on because I want to talk to the most qualified person I can find about what it takes to prepare for the Ironman World Championships in training as a professional triathlete. Dan not only coaches world-class professional triathletes, but also holds the overall age group course record at the Ironman World Championships in Kona. So there really is no one more knowledgeable in this sport. Dan, thanks so much for being here, mate.
No, thanks for having me back on, Jack. It's good to be back again. I enjoyed our first chat, so it was easy when the request came through. It was a definite easy decision.
I reckon the first episode I did with you up until that point might have got the most positive feedback of any episode I've ever done. It's probably been overtaken by another one, like one of your contemporaries now, Dan Larang. His episode really got a lot of good feedback. So the challenge I set to you here is to like leapfrog him again to become the biggest like drawer of good feedback of any coach in triathlon.
That's not an easy task. But yeah, I will do my best. But yeah, I mean, I actually have, that's on my listening to list, but I haven't managed to listen to it yet. But I definitely want to listen to your one with Dan because I'm sure it'll be super super interesting as well.
Hey, let's just jump straight into the guts of what I want to chat about, and that's preparing for the Ironman World Championships, and from the lens of a world-class coach like yourself. It's like, I'm going to ask questions, but I almost feel underqualified to ask them with a guy like you, and I almost want to just give you the floor and say, hey, give us a 45-minute monologue on what it takes to prepare as a professional triathlete for the Ironman World Championships, but I will do my best. For starters, is preparing for the Ironman World Championships as a professional athlete any different to preparing, trying to win any other professional Ironman in the world?
Yeah, I think it is when you consider Kona, because as everyone knows, in Kona, the heat is such a massive driver of the overall outcome of the event. So I think you just have to take that into account. And I think the environmental conditions of any race always have to be considered, right? Even at Utah, because it was at a modest altitude, it was around 700 meters, but people were still thinking about that. So, you know, so if it's altitude or it's in the heat or it's a very dry climate or whatever it might be, you still have to be very specific to the types of conditions that you're going to be racing in. So I think that the training itself doesn't change too much in terms of the volumes and the session types that you're doing and the numbers that you might be trying to hit with in terms of training. But the heat consideration and the very specific heat acclimation definitely needs to be considered. And you can't do both, because obviously there's a lot of athletes who like to include altitude training in there as part of their preparation for any event. But I don't think it's really possible to do both. I think you have to do one or the other, because the overall environmental stress just becomes too much, and then you can end up cooking yourself, for want of a better word. So I think the difference is really that Kona is very specific, and the specific nature of it is coming from the heat, really.
And like I follow a lot of professional triathletes who are preparing for the Ironman World Championships on Instagram, and I see quite a few at altitude, and I see quite a few that are like training somewhere hot. Like if you look at Patrick Lang or Braden Curry, for example, they've opted to not go altitude and they're going heat. And for example, the Norwegians, they tend to go the altitude path. Which one do you think is more effective if you're going to do a training camp in the lead up to the Ironman World Championships? Which one would you be prescribing?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely be prescribing the heat, because when you're learning sports science and you're learning coaching, there's always something called the principles of training, which people may be or may not be familiar of. And like some of the things in the principles of training, it's all around like frequency, so how much you train, overload, making sure you're doing some overload training, reversibility, so if you stop training, you lose your fitness. And one of the main ones in the principles of training, which is a very simplified method of training, is specificity. And I think that specificity is always the thing that will win out in the end of the day. And I can't believe that the Norwegians won't be including some heat. They might be doing some altitude now in the early stages, but I guarantee that, you know, in the last 3 weeks before the event, they'll start to do some, I'm sure they'll start to do some heat acclimation protocols in the build up to that. But there's so many different ways you can do it. There's so many different ways that you can prepare. You could do altitude training with a little bit of sauna, for example, so passive heat, which has been shown to be very beneficial for making some of those early adaptations in heat acclimation, and then go and then do 3 weeks before, go to a heat training camp, and you could then get the best of both worlds, because in many instances the benefits of altitude come 3 weeks after you come down to sea level. So but there's lots of different ways you can do it. I remember Craig Alexander, I was talking with him at the Collins Cup actually, and he was saying, you know, that he lived in Boulder for lots of his preparation, but when it came to Kona, he realized that he couldn't do heat and altitude at the same time. So he would always prefer to go with the heat acclimation, because he felt that that was much more important for Kona than altitude.
Yeah, I always hear, like, nowadays there's a lot of discussion around heat training having very similar effects when it comes to what's going on with your blood as altitude. Obviously, we know that you go to altitude so that you have like a higher red blood cell count, which helps with how aerobically fit we are. And you know, it was never really talked about until recently that heat training might have the same or similar impacts on our physiology. Is that actually true? And like, or is there any benefit at all to picking altitude over heat, or do you get both the specificity aspect of Kona being hot, as well as like the improvements in like red blood cell count that you might get from altitude being in the heat as well? Like, is it just like a win-win basically?
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, but there's in the lots of the research and the literature now, people talk around. They say, oh, you know, heat is the new altitude. And the good thing about the heat is it's cheaper. It's generally a lot easier to do. You know, it's easier to get yourself in a sauna or make your own heat box in your house. And, you know, on both sides, the hematological changes that are associated with altitude and with sauna. So even at altitude, it's not a guarantee that you're going to see some good hematological changes. Often, you know, we talk about responders and non-responders to altitude, and sometimes we'll see some pretty big increases. I had an athlete who was doing some training in Sierra Nevada earlier in the year, and we had, you know, a 6% increase in hematocrit over a 3 week period, which is a massive amount. It's huge. So for that particular instance, it worked, but then went again, you don't see the same responses. So it's you're not always guaranteed to get a hematological change even with altitude. So you're not always guaranteed to get a hematological change with heat training as well, because it depends on so many different things. We do talk about responders and non-responders, but I don't believe that's the case. It's how you manipulate the training to get the right response. So people who don't really respond to altitude, for example, generally they train a little bit too hard. They probably aren't looking at the nutrition or having the iron levels measured and taking the right supplements when they're at altitude. So there's things that can be done wrong so that mean you don't elicit the correct response. But there is some great research that has shown that, you know, red blood cells do increase with with heat. But there's been some that have shown there's no response as well. So it's a little bit unequivocal, really. But I would say that it's probably not as guaranteed as with altitude, but there's definitely something that happens, and there is definitely something going on. Also, you definitely will see some good changes in your blood plasma volume. So increases in blood plasma volume would be, you know, it's a very specific adaptation for heat training. More blood plasma volume can, you know, obviously there's more than greater water content in the blood, can be associated with lower heart rates when exercising. So you can see those heart rate levels at the submaximal level come closer to what you would see at more of a temperate condition as well. So even training in the heat, for example, it does show. I mean, we've done some great research. We actually did some research in our own lab that showed that training in the heat was better than training in a temperate condition for exercising in a temperate condition. And that's not exercising in the heat. So, yeah.
that probably leads me on to my next question, really, is that you've mentioned passive heat. So what you mean by that for the layperson is you might go and raise your core body temperature in a sauna or a hot bath or whatever the method you use is pre or post doing a training session. Like, so for example, you might jog for 30 minutes and then hop in a sauna for 30 minutes afterwards. But is that the only like form of heat training professional athletes are doing at the Ironman to prepare for the Ironman World Championships, or are they doing that combined with making sure that they're getting out and doing their rides and their runs in the middle of the day when it's, you know, 30, 35 degrees Celsius, or like in a heat room? Like, are they on a kicker doing their sessions in a really like climate controlled hot room?
I think everyone's doing lots of variations of different things, but if you look at the research and you look at the effectiveness, I think it's like a scale of, you know, the gold standard to, you know, it's okay, it'll do, but you can't beat going to the actual climate that you're in and training in the climate that you're going to compete in. So, you know, going to Maui, going to Kona, doing a heat block there is the best way to do it. And it really has to be a period of 3 weeks. You see a lot of physiological changes very, very quick in terms of increasing blood plasma volume, rest, like heart rates coming back to the kind of temperate condition levels within a week, but your endurance takes quite a long time. So your durability in the heat takes a long time to come up, and that takes about 3 weeks to do. So I think that is the best way. I think the research shows that is the best way, but you can use a combination of the passive heat to quicken your response. So one of the things that's often done is that you might do some passive heat before you go on your heat acclimation training camp. So before you go to where you're going to do your training in the hot environment, you might do some sauna before. So you kind of get used to it and adapt a little bit quicker, so you're not wasting so much time. Another way is you can go and do your heat acclimation, come out of it, maintain some of those adaptations using passive heat, and then go back just there just before the race, because the plasticity of response is a lot quicker. The more you're exposed to something, the quicker your adaptation to it. It's just like with training. People who have trained a lot chronically all their life, when they start training again, everyone knows that they seem to get quick, really, really quick. It's the same with altitude. So a lot of repeated exposure of altitude, you adapt a lot quicker. Repeated exposures to heat, you adapt a lot quicker to the heat. So that's where sauna and passive heat can help. But I think the most ideal is that passive sauna, passive heating is used in conjunction with a heat training camp. That's the best way to tackle it, I believe.
And so when you're like preparing, like, because obviously you can do all the heat training in the world, but you know, the training still has to be right. Like you can be heat acclimatized, but if you're not fit, you're not going to win the race, are you? So where is that? How do you balance those two things where you go over to, like, let's say you go over to Hawaii 4 weeks before the race to meet that 3 weeks minimum that you think you need to prepare, and it's like 30 degrees all day every day and really humid. Do you go over there and still do the exact same amount of training as a professional triathlete as you would if you were training somewhere that was, you know, 20 degrees or 15 degrees, or is it like sort of a sacrifice where it's like, okay, I've got to go over and do this next like 3-4 week block in like a really hot climate, and that means that my training has to decrease in intensity and volume so that I'm not completely overcooked? And like, where's that balance between training hard but not training too hard so that the heat cooks you?
Yeah, exactly. And of course, I think a big mistake that a lot of people make is they go out to the hot conditions too early. I mean, you know, I see some athletes that out at the moment, you know, they've been out there for 5-6 weeks. In my opinion, that's too long. I think you can, no matter what and how much you reduce your training, whatever you do, I think you can end up just being a little bit stale for one and a little bit overcooked from just too much heat. And what happens over time is for many people, they have to reduce their powers and numbers. And in the research that we did, it was a 3 weeks training intervention. So what we did is we had 3 weeks of training. You either trained in, it was cycling only, you did a pre and post time trial, and you either trained in a temperate condition or you trained in the heat, but training was capped on heart rate, so you had to do it at the exact same heart rate. So it was heart rate zones, not power based training prescription. So what happened inevitably was, you know, you're doing your 10x3 minutes in the heat chamber, and the power is, you know, 30-40% less than what you would do in the temperate conditions. But having said that, the temperate condition, the heat training group, still improved the most. They improved more than the ones training in the temperate condition, even though their power was less, because of there was more adaptations going on. We measured some specific adaptations that you can look at, something called citrate synthase activity, which measures how much mitochondria the proteins are being turned over. So we can kind of look at that and go, okay, there's more of that. It means that there's more adaptation going on. And we saw that more in the heat group. So definitely positive. But my feeling is, if you're there too long, you will end up losing a bit of muscular strength and muscular endurance, because you're simply not doing the same powers and the same speeds anymore because of the temperature. So that's that's my feeling, is that you can be there for too long regardless. So if you are there for a long period of time, you can overcook yourself. But there are some specific things to do in training when you first arrive to kind of mitigate that. So like when we actually published some other research that we showed that the best thing to do is that basically heart rate zones don't really change. So your aerobic threshold and your anaerobic threshold in the heat or in temperate is the same. So when you first go to the heat and you're training in the heat, move to heart rate prescribed training rather than power and pace prescribed training. And that's the biggest thing that people or athletes or pros need to make the change for at least 1 to 2 weeks, is that you train off heart rate, not off power and pace. Then as you see kind of a normalization of what you would see normally in the temperate condition, it will happen over a 2 week period, then you can switch back for maybe that final week to more of the heat based, to more of the power and pace based training.
So this is where I want to extrapolate this. Are you better off in general, not even talking about preparing for the Ironman World Championships, but just in general as a triathlete or endurance athlete, are you just better to live and train in hot conditions year round, so that you're getting these like chronic adaptations to the training you're doing, but you also don't have to train as hard to get them? And like, could you just like offset that by being in the gym a bit more, so you don't lose like your muscular endurance or strength or like maximal force capacity while you're also doing this slightly easier training, but just doing it in the heat?
No, I think not. I think you wouldn't be very, I think it wouldn't be very beneficial to be there all year round. And if you think about it, typically in those like tropical Southeast Asian countries, we don't typically see a lot of really good endurance athletes coming from there. And I think it's the reason being, it is just too hot and you lose some muscular strength. And no matter what happens, you know, you can't replicate that in the gym, because it's a very different type of strength. Like a muscular endurance, you know, a 3 hour ride where you might be in a temperate condition and say you're doing 260 watts compared to a 3 hour ride when you're in a very hot conditions and you might do 200 watts, it's quite different. I think the best combination is that you are in a kind of not a cold climate, but you know, a nice climate that's pleasant for training in, that's reasonably warm, where you know, around a typical kind of, you know, typical Australia, right, where it's kind of hot for some parts of the year, it's not, you know, kind of a seasonal place, and then you'll inject those specific heat blocks when you need them around racing.
And then let's sort of moving away from the like heat specifically to just the broader preparing for an Ironman World Championships. With these professionals like the Christian Blumenfelds and the Gustav Edens, Jan Frodenos, Braden Currys, do you think that, like, is there some common links between all of the best guys and girls training when it comes to the Ironman World Championships? Or is it really similar to just like any other race where each individual sort of trains how they train and they rely on that to get them prepared? Like, or is there some specific things that you see lots of different pros doing and like some specific things you would prescribe, for example, that everyone should be doing outside of specific heat adaptation to prepare in training for the Ironman World Championships?
Yeah, I mean, there are a few specifics. I think one is pros compared to age groupers. I think I always include a bit more variable power in the time trial efforts, for example. If you did 4x40 minutes, for example, for an age grouper, you could probably hold just a very consistent power. But for a pro, because of just the nature of racing where they're trying to keep the 10-meter gap and it's a little bit more surgy. So you have to take that into account that you will need to include, if you're doing 40-minute efforts every 5 minutes, you might include 1 to 2 minutes at a higher power, for example, just to kind of replicate the race a little bit more. So I think that's one thing, is trying to be as specific towards the dynamics of the race as you possibly can. Of course, when it comes to the sea and swimming with a non-wetsuit, I think, you know, making sure that we're not swimming too much in our floaty pants and pool boys and doing too much pool paddles, you know, we have to get used to just swimming normally, right? Because that makes a difference. And I think triathletes can often become too dependent on toys a lot, you know, for the swimming. So I think that's one thing that I always consider when it comes to racing in Kona, is that it is a non-wetsuit swim. So it's, that does make a difference to the preparation. I think if you're in a wetsuit, you can include a bit more pool, a bit more pool paddles, a bit more, you know, floaty pants in your preparation. So that's another thing to consider. And then also with the bike riding, for the pros in particular, I always try and consider the crunch points of the race. And if you look at the crunch points of the race, it's always on the way back down from Harvey. So I will, and that's, and the reason being is because it's slightly downhill, but there's still a lot of power being put down. And that's quite a specific adaptation. It's quite hard to do power going down a gradual hill. It's a very difficult thing to do. So I'll always try and include something a little bit more specific around that as well. They're the things that I'm mainly considering when it comes to Kona. And then on the run, of course, it's, you know, just pacing and kind of everyone man for himself once you get to that point, right? But they're the things that I really consider for Kona. There's also those pinch points that always happen in the race.
And do you think, like, do the pros, like, sort of think about how the race might play out? Like, do they look at the fact that at St. George for the previous edition of the Ironman World Championships, there was, like, a really strong front swim pack that formed that went off the front on the ride? And so do they go, oh, well, like, if you're borderline going to make that pack, do they start thinking like, okay, let's do huge amounts of swim volume to make sure we try and get into that pack because that's going to make our race easier? Or do they, you know, the opposite? Do they go, well, this is going to be a running race because Christian and Gustav are going to, like, that they're going to run 2:35 and you're going to have to run that to compete these days. So do they do like heaps of run volume and try and get a bit skinnier? And like the women, do they look at what Daniela Reef did and think, oh shit, like we've got to be able to ride, you know, way faster than what we have been in the past to even be a chance to win this race, or else she'll ride 15 minutes into us and there's the race gone. So they just do huge ride volume in the build up, or do they more just go, well, we're just going to train the way we train to our strengths to try and be the best triathletes we can be to win, and not really specifically to how the race dynamics might play out?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag, really. I think some people will definitely, I mean, your first example where you talked about someone who's just off that front group of the swim and might look to really improve the swimming to make that front pack, you know, I think that could definitely happen. And you know, if someone feels that they need to get a gap on the bike and they can't because they won't have the run legs, and that's definitely going, you know, people will definitely gear their training towards the way they feel the race will unfold for them. But I also, in that same breath, I do think it's a little bit of a dodgy, you know, it is a dodgy ground, because if you plan the race that way and then it doesn't unfold that way, it's kind of, your race is over immediately as well. So it's quite dangerous to do that way. But I definitely think that people, I'm not saying it's wrong, but I think it's definitely something that people consider. I mean, like, I think when it comes to Kona, the old saying of cycle for show, run for dough is so true, because if you can pull together a good run at Kona, you will inevitably have a good race. And I always think, you know, an average bike and an average bike, average swim with a good run will generally get you on the podium, you know. So people, and that's what we see all the time. Like David McNamee for years got on the podium with a very average bike, average swim, and very good run, jumped on the podium. And you know, even Patrick Langer would be the same. So I think that's how I look at the race. I always weight the running in Kona more highly than I would for another race, because just because of the way things work as well, is that if you look at the laws of like heat, like basically metabolism and metabolic heat production, when it comes to racing in the heat, the amount of power that you have to produce to go a little bit faster is quite a lot. And that means a lot more metabolic heat. It means you get a lot hotter. It means you burn through a lot more glycogen, because we know that in the heat, you spin more glycogen than you would normally. Your fat oxidation is reduced, particularly as you get over that first aerobic threshold. So that's what I always think of, is that you've got to back your run a little bit more and work on that to have a good race in Kona, because you cook there's not many people who can go off the front on the bike and then hold on for a really good marathon. Doesn't happen. I mean, it does happen, of course. Norman Stadler did it. Frodeno did it. But it doesn't happen too often. It's always the people who are kind of coming, who are sitting in a little bit more and saving the cookie, so to speak.
It is funny how many times in Kona people have come out of nowhere off the bike, like 10, 20 minutes down to run into the podium in both the men's and women's race. It does happen almost every second year. Which I've never really considered, but now that you say that, it makes sense, because it is a race where like almost all of the field just capitulates at some point on the run, don't they? And it really does, more than any Ironman pretty much on the planet, become a race of survival on the run. And you're right, like, yeah, every year or two there's that one guy or girl that's just running strong through the field and moves from like 16th place right up to third place, or you know, 20th up to fifth, and there's a lot in that. So what do you do as a coach? How do you approach that? Is that a training thing? Is that like becoming a really strong but like cyclist, so that you can put in a little less power and run stronger? Or is it putting way more emphasis on your run training, particularly like maybe your run training when it comes to like volume or specific like race pace type stuff in the heat? Or is it really just as simple as not over swimming and biking on the day, so that you have the run legs to run through the field?
Yeah, it's both. I think, you know, the stronger you can be on the bike, of course, that helps massively. Because the fresher you will be getting onto the run, the more easily you can get onto the start of the bike with as much energy as possible, that's going to be the best thing for you, right? It's great. And then of course, so a strong bike with good running would be really advantageous. But I do think that the key, rather than running really well, I think it's important to be in good run shape, of course, but I think being in very good bike shape is equally as important as being in good run shape for a good run performance. So it's a triathlon, right? I think you have to focus on all three. But then on the day, it's about being very specific in what you're trying to do, and not getting too caught up in the race and going off doing big surges and trying to, you know, do it, just doing something that's, you're not doing everything you can to conserve energy, because at the end of the day, it is a conservation of energy game. And that's even stronger when it comes to exercising in the heat. Racing in the heat. So that's how I would tackle it. I mean, even if I go back to like my race in 2018, if you look at my splits, my swim was very average. My bike was very average. But my run was the thing that was the difference between, you know, in everything, really. Yeah, I think I was like, I think in the age group race, I was the, you know, maybe 30th out of the water, maybe the 15th or 20th on the bike. But my run was the fifth fastest in the entire race, including the pros. And that was the difference. And I think that's what's important in Kona. It's all about the running. And that's what, I mean, with Chelsea, that's what we're focusing on at the moment. I'm really trying to get her to start thinking about the race and how she needs to control herself on the bike and the swim to put in a good run performance. And because if she puts in a good run performance as a woman, you can get under 2:55. You'll very likely be on the podium. And I think she's more than capable of doing that. So yeah, it's kind of what we're trying to focus on.
With the heat, this is a question I've always wanted to know, and it stems from a conversation, or multiple conversations, both on the podcast and in private, I've had with three-time Ironman world champion, you know, no one's really done this race better than him, Craig Alexander. He always says that he believes the Ironman world championships suit a bigger triathlete, and he strongly believes that if you're too skinny come race day on Kona, you're not going to perform well, or as well as you could if you were carrying slightly more weight. And I know there's like another famous case of this exact concept is his arch rival throughout his career, Chris McCormack, who was having really up and down performances at Kona, and he really attributes one of the big factors as to finding some consistency and becoming really the one of the best of his era to race at Kona down to being a little bit heavier all year, including on the race day, like getting a little bit lighter for race day, but being quite a bit heavier, you know, like quite a few kilos heavier than what he thought he should race at. But my brain tells me that to run fast in the heat, particularly that late into a race, that being lighter should help that should keep your core body temperature a little bit lower. You know, you just have less body weight, so you should use a little bit less energy to move for the same pace. Can you help me with the science and the truth behind this? What is the best way to approach it? Should you be focusing on being a little bit heavier and or a little bit lighter to run well at the Ironman World Championships?
Yeah, who knows on that one? So what I think on to answer those questions. So fat, I mean, people, like when you're a bit fatter, you do get a little bit hotter, but it's not as much as what people believe it to be. I mean, people think that fat acts as an insulator, but it does make you a little bit hotter, but more because the fat itself heats up and the fat then heats you. And that's been shown in some good research that, yeah, if you do hold more adipose tissue, it does make it a little bit hotter, but it's not much. And the difference between, you know, when you talk about Craig Alexander or Chris McCormack, who say, oh, you know, I was a little bit heavier, you're probably saying they're probably holding about 1 to 0.5% more body fat than if they were super skinny or super lean. So I don't think we're talking about massive differences. But one of the things that makes a bigger difference in terms of being lighter is economy and efficiency. So there's also another great research that came out of Australia that it had matched groups that looked at with the same VO2 max. So runners who had the exact same VO2 max and looked at their ability to come down to the heat, because people think, oh, the fitter you are, the better you are at coping with the heat, which is true to an extent. But when you match them for VO2 max, which generally they are in a pro race that probably have very, very similar VO2 max values, it then came to economy. So the people who were the most efficient had better economy, are the people who would generally be better in the heat because they're more efficient. The main driver of getting hot is not duration. Duration has nothing to do with how hot you feel. It is all to do with exercise intensity. So the harder you go, the hotter you feel, which is why the pros are always generally at risk of overheating more than the age groupers, because they're producing a lot more power and therefore a lot more metabolic heat. So if you can be more efficient and your economy and efficiency is lower, at the same power or the same pace, you are producing less metabolic heat and therefore you don't get as hot. And that's the main difference. So being a bit lighter in that aspect can could help for sure. But just to finish off the last point where, you know, Chris McCormack and Craig Alexander say being a little bit lot heavier helped them. I don't know whether it's actually to do with the racing, or my feeling is it's probably more to do with their preparation. So if they, you know, if you're more tired, you're more stressed when you go into a into the heat, you generally don't cope with the heat as well. And that's been shown a lot in the research as well, is that if you if you're more tired before going into heat exposure, you feel hotter, your thermal comfort is much worse, you generally don't perform as well. So I think if you're really lean going in, you probably try to stay lean, you're probably not eating as much, you've probably done a little bit more training, so you're a little bit overtrained or overdone going in, and that's the reason why you don't perform as well. And I think when it comes to cone, it's better to be undercooked than overcooked. If you're going overcooked into a hot climate, you're guaranteed to have a bad race, where you can probably get away with it just a little bit more if you're in a temperate conditions. And that's probably why they believe that to be the case, and not specifically because of that, because they were a little bit heavier. I don't think that's having any influence on the actual race day, so to speak.
So what you're saying there is, if you can be as light as you possibly can be, right, and theoretically you're not like being, you know, you're still eating enough and you're not mentally draining yourself by stressing about your weight, or it's not a big focus. Like, let's say, for example, I just talked to Joe Skipper and he said that he hasn't been focusing on his weight at all. And like, he's just been eating a really like clean, healthy diet. And he looked in the mirror and he's like, oh shit, I'm looking like skinny. And then he went and raced Ironman Wales and ran the fastest he's ever ran in a marathon by a mile. And he attributes a fair bit of it to being that little bit lighter, like much lighter than he has been in his career ever before. But he said it wasn't a focus for him at all. He had his dad cooking for him on training camp, so he just wasn't as eating as much junk and that kind of thing. If you can theoretically be as light as possible, but not like contribute to like any more stress than like what it would if you were a little bit heavier, is that theoretically like the best practice?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's not about the stress. It's about it's mostly about if you can still get to the race day very fresh and very ready to race and not at all overtrained and a bit overdone. I think that's the main outcome of that. I mean, but I don't think lighter, when you said as light as possible, there's still a point of diminishing returns, is that you get too light, you get too skinny, you lose power on the bike. And that's definitely a thing as well. Like, I think you can get, if you get too light, you will lose a bit of that power, which is going to be really, really important. I mean, from my own personal experience, I raced Kona in 2015, I raced Kona in 2018, and I was about maybe 3 kilograms heavier in 2018, but I went 908 in 2015 at a lighter weight and 824 in 2018. So it doesn't always mean just because you're lighter, you're going to run better. And I just remember specifically there was a picture of the exact same picture taken by the exact same photographer, who obviously just does race day photography, on from a side profile of me in 2015 compared to 2018. And I'm exactly the same, but my quads are about twice the size in 2018, you know? So I think it's not lighter, it's always better. But I think being, you know, finding your optimal race weight within reason, and being on the start line, ready to race, not overcooked, nice and fresh, is the most important thing.
When you're coaching a professional athlete, or even an age group athlete for this matter, how do you figure out what an individual's optimal race weight is, like Ironman World Championships or not? How do you possibly figure that out? Like, is it just a heap of trial and error? Like, oh, let's see if you race better at this weight or this weight or this weight, or is there like certain things you're looking for, whether it be like body fat percentage, or is it like performance metrics that you use to judge it? Like, how do you even go about finding what your optimal race weight is for an Ironman?
Yeah, I mean, it's the only way you can really do it is a bit of trial and error, but I think it's not something that you should really pursue and try and look for yourself, because I think and what you said before about Joe Skipper, I think it'll be what it will be. And I just don't really get too caught up in the whole weight thing with my athletes. Generally, I just encourage them to eat well, eat the correct macronutrients, so the right ratios of fats, carbohydrates, and proteins, and then the rest will take care of itself. You don't have to worry about it too much. I think the moment you start trying to play around with that stuff, you get on a bit of a slippery slope, If you wanted to do it, the only way you could really do it is through trial and error, but I don't really encourage it.
So, like, this is like really, it's just like an evolving thing with endurance sport, isn't it? That, like, at one point in time, like, weight can be a massive factor. Like, I just remember through like the Raylert, Macca, Crowe era, like, I would just hear weight talked about in triathlon all the time. And now I reckon we're shifting more towards what you said, where, you know, some people focus on it, but me and you, we talked about in our last episode, the Natalia Donut boys, the Norwegians, who really don't seem to focus, like Christian doesn't seem to focus on it much at all. And like, where do you, like, where is the, I know you just said that you just think if you don't worry about it, then like, it'll just be what it be will be, and that's healthy. But like, is there technically, like, if you could take away the mentality side of things, physically, will the same athlete like run a faster marathon if they're a kilo lighter and the training is all the same? Like, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how do you convince someone that weight doesn't matter when for long periods of time that they've been told it really does matter, or, you know, being that kilo or two lighter and focusing on that number on the scale won't really matter? How do you talk to your athletes about that? How do you make, like, people in a body conscious sport where weight and being lean and skinny is really idolized by the large majority of us? And the amount of triathletes I talk to who say, like, oh, if I could just be a little bit lighter, if I was, like, you know, a bit skinnier, and they're like quite self-conscious about it, or they go to the pool and they're self-conscious about it. Like, how do you have these conversations with athletes?
Yeah, well, I think it's about changing the mindset, really. And you don't, I mean, yeah, okay, being lighter is faster, but that's not how you achieve it. You can't just say, be lighter. I think the way that I treat that is I convince the athletes that it's not important to be lighter to run faster. What's important is that you eat properly and you have the correct nutrition, you eat the correct diet. And, you know, that's what you focus on. You focus on that, because if you get that bit right, then the leanness will be in place regardless. So if you make that the primary focus of the athlete, eating correctly, eating the correct macronutrients, eating at the right at the right time, and not saying, oh, you need to get lighter, that it's a pointless thing to even say, because it's not the process. You've got to, you teach the athlete the process, not the outcome. And if you teach them the process, you almost don't even have to talk about the weight, because if they get the process right, the rest will be fine. The weight will be correct. But yeah, they will, you know, they will run faster if they're lighter, definitely. But they won't necessarily swim and bike faster, and they won't necessarily run faster off the bike. So, you know, it's not, that's why it is, you know, it's why finding the right point is correct. But I think to get to the point where you, from my experience, to get to the point where you're really, really light, and you are so light that it's at the point where you're cycling and swimming worse, you are having to generally restrict as well. So when I say restrict, you're having to think about how much you're eating rather than what you're eating. I think that for most part, you can just think about what you're eating, and that if you're exercising well, you know, think about what you eat, then you'll be fine.
And now back to training a little bit. Just like I know it's so hard because it's so individualistic, but I hate those answers of like, well, it depends on the individual. So I'm going to try and get you to give me some broad sort of statements here, despite probably going against everything you believe in. When it comes to professionals training for the Ironman World Championships, what kind of stuff are they doing? Like, I know that specifically on this podcast, we do talk to individuals to hear exactly what that individual is doing, but just in general, for the layperson wondering how these people prepare, like how the Christian Blumenfelds and the Jan Frodenos and the Daniela Reefs prepare, how much sort of volume are all those guys doing? And like, how hard actually is their training? How long are training blocks leading into the Ironman World Championships? Like, how focused are they? And how do those blocks generally look, and everything in that realm?
Yeah. I mean, I think the training volumes, they vary from between 25 to 35 hours a week, depending on what, you know, the timing of before the event and who the athlete is. Like Chelsea, for example, she's just done a big training block. She went to Kona, she did 30 hours of training in a week. You know, that's a lot for her. But new, usually, the, but now we're bringing it back down a little bit, and she'll get closer to 20, between 20 and 25 for this last kind of little period as a as an example. But I think the training doesn't really change between all of them. I think they're all, I think I might, I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I have seen some training from other athletes. Because what they're generally doing is they're doing training that's very specific towards the event. Most of it's like endurance focused. I don't think they're doing any, they're not doing anything harder than what an age group is doing. They're just doing more of it, you know, and that generally the more comes from lower volume aerobic training. So they're doing a lot of aerobic training with some very specific works at and around Ironman pace. And then just a tiny little bit of high intensity just to keep the engine fired up, so to speak, just to keep the top end there, because that's also so still important, even if they're training for a race that lasts for more than around 8 hours. I wouldn't say more than 8 hours, but yeah, so even if training an event like that, that's kind of what they're doing. So it's a lot of specific work around the race pace, a lot of aerobic volume, and then just a little sprinkle of higher intensity work. And I think that's what they're all doing.
And specifically to the Ironman World Championships versus other Ironman races, or even compared to like Olympic distance racing or 70.3 distance racing, what are the physiological traits of people who perform well at Kona? I mean, there's some perfect examples that I think of when I think of this, like who's raced better relative to their career or their other career results than Patrick Lang as an example. And you know,
yeah.
Danielle Arif yeah. has also been one of those people who's been incredibly consistent at Kona. She's a bit different because she's incredibly consistent everywhere.
Yeah.
But there is no doubt athletes who tend to perform better at Kona or way better at Kona than what they do for like other races in their career. Some other really obvious examples are like Ben Hoffman. Who's done it better than him? He has had like barely any good results like outside of Kona, like world class field results. He like his Kona races just far exceed the rest of his resume. Tim O'Donnell's another example. I even think Miranda Carfrae is another example, like a great triathlete who's won Kona multiple times, but I don't think did anything really exceptional outside of Kona. But what she did at Kona was like proper exceptional. What are the physiological traits that separate those who overperform versus underperform at Kona?
Yeah, well, it comes back to the conversation that we had before, and it's economy and efficiency. Like I wrote a blog on our website, endureiq.com, and it was about running economy and VO2 max and why having a big engine is probably not going to be what you really want for a good performance in Kona. Because if you typically have a very, very high VO2 max, you achieve your speed, like let's just take running, for example, you achieve your running by a lot of VO2 consumption, right? And a lot of VO2 consumption is linked with metabolic heat. You're generally getting a lot hotter. So I think that those athletes who are performing well probably have a smaller engine. So they have a smaller VO2 max. And Jan Frodeno is another person. We know he has a low VO2 max because he said it in numerous podcasts. I think he said he's low 70s, which is quite low for someone of his ability.
Dan, just to interrupt there, you got to listen to Dan Lerang's podcast because we talk about this. 72 is his VO2 max compared to Christian Blumenfeld, who's 92.
There you go. So there's a prime example. So we'll see if Christian goes well in Kona. So if you think about now what that means, right? If you have Christian and Jan both running together, they're both running your 335s, right? You know, Christian could be at 92, he could be at 90% of his VO2 max. It would be a bit less than that, but say he's at 80% of his VO2 max, and Jan would be 80% of his VO2 max, for example. His efficiency would have to be so much better than Christian's to run at the same speed. So therefore, his metabolic heat production is a lot less. And I think that's where where we see the differences is that those who are doing well in Kona probably have a smaller engine and are a little bit naturally more efficient. And Patrick Langer clearly is very efficient at running. You just need to watch him run. And I would imagine he's also got quite a low VO2 max. And that's why he's so good at that specific event. And he's also quite small. So being smaller helps in that regard as well. Obviously, it doesn't help that much in the bike, but yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the main difference that we see is just the way that they produce power and engine size versus efficiency.
So you're pretty much, without, I don't want to assume too much here, you're hypothesizing that Christian Blumenfeld isn't going to do as well at Kona as, say, he did at St. George or what he does at other Ironman or Ironman 70.3 races.
Yeah, I will hypothesize that for sure. Yeah. I'm not saying he's not going to win or be on the podium, but I don't think he'll just clean. I think it'll be as obvious of, as a whitewash as it as as before.
If you had to look at these people like the same way you've just gone, well, I assume Patrick Lang has a relatively low VO2 max, but he's super efficient. And the guy I want to focus on, and sorry if we're talking too much about the men's field and not the women's field here, but this is just really interesting to me, is Gustav Iden. He looks to be probably the most efficient runner in triathlon. Like, no one looks easier at 3:10 per K than Gustav Iden to my eye. And I know that he doesn't quite have the same VO2 max as Christian Blumenfeld. I think it is more in that high 70s, low 80s from what I've seen. Does that mean that like, should we be looking at him as the favorite and not Christian for this race?
I mean, I think that Christian will always be the favorite because he's the current world champion. But if I was a betting man, I'd put my money on Gustav over Christian. If I had to bet, that's who I would. And I also think he's a smarter racer, and that's everything in that race. Is that if you go too hard too early, you can't cool down. You can't dissipate the heat. The only way you can cool down. So if you think about what that means, you go really hard really early. Or you do something that's a bit above your threshold, or where you should be. You produce a lot of metabolic heat. You increase your core temperature, and you can't dissipate the heat because of the humidity. So the way we cool is we sweat. The sweat evaporates, and that's what cools us, which is why Kona is such a problem. The humidity, we don't really evaporate the heat very well, so we can't dissipate heat, which means we don't cool down as easily. And the only way you can really cool yourself down is to stop or slow down a lot. So I think Gustav, to me, he looks like a much smarter racer generally. He looks like he's someone who's a bit more reserved and a bit calmer in his racing. And, you know, you just have to watch him race. You don't see him for half the race, and suddenly he's there at the end, crossing the finish line first. You know, so I think if I had to bet, that's who my money will be on. I'm not saying either of them will win, but out of those two, yeah, that's who my money will be on.
Right. Well, okay. I have to ask this now that you've said that. I was going to go a different direction, but who is your money on if you can include the whole field?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about that either.
You've got more of like a, you've got a, what is it? What's the saying for when you've got something in the race, like you're invested in it? You've got Chelsea obviously racing in the women's professional race. More skin in the game, is that what the saying is?
Yeah, more skin in the game, yeah.
In the game. So I'm wondering, do you pay more attention to the women's race at the moment? And like, do you think that anyone can beat Daniela Ryf this year?
Well, I've got Jan van Berkel in the men's race as well.
God, I forget about Jan, but I was on his Instagram yesterday. How bad's that?
Yeah. I got old the Berkelizer in there.
He looks fit, Jan.
Yeah, he's going well. He's going well. I mean, with him, right? When I started first coaching Jan, he's a very realistic person, very realistic athlete, which is really important for me. And he, you know, never said he wants to win Kona or anything like that. But I think you know, we can get him in the top 10 would be great. Top 5 would be amazing. And I think that's, you know, if he can run how he has run in some of his other races, I think that's that's a possibility. So and then then I think with Chelsea, it's only a second ever Ironman, right? So I don't think it's I think for her it's just having a very conservative race, and I think if she does that and she focuses on doing a good marathon, then she'll do well. That's my feeling.
And yeah, do you think anyone can beat Daniela? Do you think that's a realistic possibility if Daniela has her sort of best race, or even if she doesn't, do you think she's beatable on that course?
I think it's at the moment. I thought Lucy Charles would have been there, but I don't think she's in that shape at the moment. I think, you know, from coming back from injury, like, you know, the Lucy when she won 70.3, I thought that would have been, you know, that Lucy, yes. But it's hard to say. I mean, you just don't know in Kona. I think for if Daniela has her best race, I think it's going to be really hard. So I think people have to bank on her having a not good race, really, you know, have something going wrong for her, because you know, she seems to be just out there at the moment.
And then just a few more questions about preparing for the Ironman World Championship. So is there anything you can do? And like, this maybe isn't even just about the Ironman World Championships. This might just be a triathlon in general, whether it's a 70.3 or an Ironman or whatever it is, particularly if it's in the heat. So if you're in like most triathlons are in the heat, being a summer sport, what can you do like the night before, the morning before, the week before to make sure that you race at your best? Like, for example, in my head, I think like pre-cooling and hydration and fueling and sleep. What are the things that you as like a sports scientist and a coach and someone who has performed at such a high level at the Ironman World Championships, what are the key things that you would be advising and looking at?
Yeah, well, I mean, the proper heat acclimation protocol and getting to the race on the start line fresh, I think you need to be fresher than you can't take as many risks as you would if you're racing in a temperate condition. You have to make sure that you're going to be pretty fresh and you're ready to race and not at all overcooked. So maybe a slightly longer taper or a more aggressive taper or something like that. And there's a lot of pre-cooling strategies that you can do, of course, but I just don't think any of them are really that effective. For Ironman, I think, because by the time you get out of the swim, you get in the water, you get out of the swim, you're going to be hot. And then it's just such a long race for it to have a meaningful effect. So I don't think that's really going to make any difference. Other things that are important is, you know, making sure you have some good sunscreen. Like if you get sunburned during the race, that can affect your core temperature and affect your ability to cope with the heat as well. So you want to make sure that you've got that part covered. And then making sure you're not too hot at the start of the race. So not, you know, you don't have to do pre-cooling, so to speak, but I think making sure you're not in the sun, keeping cool, keeping in the shade, you know, reducing your warm up a little bit if you do a before an Ironman, so you're not, you know, just really small. Maybe some mobilizations rather than a full jog or your normal warm routine. I would definitely look at altering that. So you start the race as cool as you can, and then during, you know, on the bike, if you can keep yourself cool, get the ice bottles, you can grab them, pull them over your head, pull them down your back, try and cool yourself down. And on the run, using the ice sponges as best you can, really.
And then probably my last question is a bit of a weird one, I reckon, but like I said, you are a scientist.
I love a weird one. Love a weird question.
It's not that weird, but it takes me back to your 2018 race. And that's footwear and specifically footwear for the Ironman World Championships. You've obviously got this bike course that's super hilly and you have that long drag downhill where you have to push like a massive gear. So it's going to be like, you know, really quite quad or glute dominant probably, like because you're probably like going down that hill at Kona for that long and having to go that fast. Like not many guys are doing that, or guys and girls, I mean, are doing that in training, like very regularly. Like maybe they do, like you said, leading up to Kona, and that's where you would be like advising people to do some work because it's like a very key point in the race and a really different point to what a lot of other races have. But you're obviously going to go into the run quite fatigued through your upper legs, through your quads and your hammies and your glutes because of that effort. And these modern super shoes that we have, they are shown with research by the companies to put more load through those areas and less load through like your foot and your calf. Is there any merit to not going like certain super shoes, like, you know, the Alpha Fly by Nike, for example, is a shoe that definitely puts more load higher up the chain versus something that's a little bit more flexible and puts a bit more load through your calf. Is there Is there any like special considerations when it comes to footwear specifically for that race that you should be taking into account to try and load areas that that aren't loaded as much during the bike but are still giving you the benefit in efficiency of the modern super shoe?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that the quad loading's any more in Kona than it would be in a normal Ironman, though. I think it's just the position of the time trial bikes and the riding that we do is very, very quad dominant. So I don't think there's any differences there. I mean, I've always been a fan of the A6 a bit more for that reason, because I do feel that they're a little bit more Ironman friendly. I'm not convinced they're necessarily faster than the Nikes, but I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but that would be a consideration that I would be making. I mean, when I raced in 2018, I wore the 4%, you know, and I felt totally fine. My quads were great on that. And in fact, I had the smallest amount of muscle soreness I've ever had at the end of an Ironman. But I'm not sure what the differences are between because they were the very first versions of like the 4% versus the Vaporflies now. I'm not sure if there's that much difference. But yeah, I think I wouldn't be trying a shoe on race day that I've never run a marathon in before in an Ironman, put it that way.
So like, say for example, if you had ran an Ironman, like your last like 70.3 or your last Ironman or even like a half marathon that you'd just done in say like the Vaporfly, like you said, and then you'd trained a little bit in an Alphafly and you were tossing up between the two. And then you also had done like a little bit in the ASICS Metaspeed Sky and you'd like, oh, and you're throwing up between them. You would just say, like, you would just strongly advise, hey, go the Vaporfly because you've done a marathon in it off the bike or you've done, you know, a half marathon off the bike and you know what that's like.
Yeah.
Even if you're in training, you're like, oh, but I think I might like these other ones a little bit more.
Yeah, I that's my feeling. And I also feel that, you know, the alpha flies are so high now, they're quite unstable and, you know, and squidgy around the foot, you know? So, you know, like they have a lot of movement when your foot hits the ground. And so there's a lot of ankle stability that needs to be, you know, to stabilize with the ankle a lot. Whereas the vapor flies and the meta speeds, they're a bit lower to the ground. So, so I think that's something that's also something to consider. But I think, you know, the old saying of nothing new on race day is not, it doesn't apply to just race shoes, right? It doesn't apply to training shoes. It applies to everything, but your training shoes are probably one of the most important pieces of kit you're going to be wearing the whole day. So you just, nothing new on race day is such an important lesson to learn for sure. And that's what, if you've raced them before, then race them on race day. But having said that, I had never run a marathon in those 4% before, but it worked out pretty well. So
do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, yeah. Dan, is there anything else you can think about that like would be really good knowledge going into the Ironman World Championships, stuff we haven't talked about that the pros are doing or that they're doing in preparation? Like I said at the start of the show, I probably would be better off just letting you do a monologue on what it takes to get ready for Kona and what are the things to think about. Like, is there anything I've missed that you think is really important or really interesting when it comes to preparing for this race?
I think, well, speaking from an age group perspective, I think a lot of age groupers get a little bit caught up in Kona, and they get a little bit too caught up in the hype. So my big word of advice is, you know, just keep yourself to yourself. Don't go outside too much, getting too stressed in the heat, in the sun. I think, you know, staying in your hotel room, just go outside to train and get out of the hype. I think it takes a lot of energy. So by the time you come to race week, you're a bit tired. And even this year, there's races going on throughout the week, right? So there's going to be a big buzz, a lot of energy in the atmosphere. So, you know, I think a good tip is to keep yourself to yourself and focus on the process, focus on what you're doing. And then, the rest will be all good come race day.
I reckon we'll wrap it up there. That was awesome. Like, this is why I asked you, mate. When I talk to you, I sit back and listen. I find myself doing this thing with you where like I'll ask the question and I go, yeah, I'm the podcast host. I know that. And then I'll ask you the question and I'll sort of lean back in my chair and I get further and further back in the chair when I'm listening to your answer with my arms crossed, sort of like looking up the roof, like thinking, because you make me think so deeply about things and you're educating me as we go. And then you stop talking. I'm like, oh, shit, I'm the podcast host. I've got to ask another question here because you sort of make me feel like I'm just listening and learning. And it's just when we were going through that, I had this thought to myself. I'm like, oh. This is just a nice reminder of why I asked Dan to come on and really why your last podcast we did was so well received. You're just, yeah, you're an absolute wealth of knowledge and it's like such a privilege to be able to talk to you about this kind of stuff, mate, and love that I can call on you when I need to get some expert training advice, particularly that's science-based and research-based. I love that about you. So can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this special Kona edition with me. I really appreciate it. And I'm sure there'll be people who listen to this and actually take so much out of it in their own racing, whether it be the Ironman World Championships or just like a hot Ironman or 70.3 that they're doing over the summer.
No, thanks, Jack. Your words are too kind. Make me blush, but no, it's always a pleasure coming on. And I hope we get a lot of positive feedback. Just get that positive feedback coming in because we've got to overtake down the rank.
I feel like I might have betrayed you a bit here, but I did actually at the end of the podcast with Dan Lerang, I told him that he's officially my coach now because he gave me a little bit of advice. So, and I really just wanted the clout of saying that my coach was the same coach as Jan Frodeno and Lucy Charles and Aaron Haag and, you know, Jai Hindley, all these people. So yeah. I might have betrayed you a little bit there, but, you know, if you want to like maybe...
Well, I'll take a listen and see how much I'm offended. No, I mean, I think he's definitely got... His repertoire of athletes is far greater than mine. So, I mean, I think I only beat him on the academic publications, I think, that one. Well, maybe Olympic medals, actually, but only because of my involvement in rowing.
yeah. And you've got Javier. You can claim them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But, yeah, thanks so much, mate. Absolute pleasure. Enjoy the rest of your day.
No, cool, man. Thank you.
See you, Dan.
Bye-bye.